Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Slosberg with Energy Justice Network, and thanks for making on this month's National Anti-Biomass Incineration Campaign call. We have the calls on the first Thursday of every month, and we focus on a particular topic relevant to biomass energy. We invite guest speakers, and then we discuss the issue. October's call topic is debunking wildfire myths. And for the next hour, we'll discuss how we can improve our advocacy about wildfire and forest practices and how those topics tie into biomass incineration. Our guest speaker is Roy Keene, public interest forester and director of our forest. Keene is based in Oregon, has more than 35 years' experience as a forester in both wet and dry western U.S. forest ecosystems. As a writer and researcher, he's drawn attention to the failings of forest policies and practices, especially under the guise of fire fuels reduction and, quote, restoration. So Roy will speak for about 15, 20 minutes, as long as he really wants to, and then we'll have the remaining time for questions. So please hold your questions until then. And again, we are recording this call so we can pass around the audio to folks inside our network and the public at large. Samantha Shirilla with Energy Justice Network will be taking notes. We'll also send those out to the listserv with the recording. So please take it away, Roy.
I think you have to start a discussion on fire with the idea that we've suppressed fire, especially in the drier east side and mixed conifer forest, for over a century. This has resulted in massive fuel loads in many forests. Again, these are typically xeric. These are typically dry to moderately dry forest that under normal conditions would have fairly regular fires. Let's say perhaps fire frequencies of 15 to 30 or 40 years. And the nature of these fires is that they were generally, not always, but generally low intensity. And a lot of the fuels and a lot of the understory in these stands was routinely consumed by these low intensity fires. The thing to remember is when the weather conditions are right, bets are off. And that's why in 1910 you had these horrendous fires in Idaho, because you had drought, you had extremely dry conditions, and then you got gale force winds and lightning, and boom, you had a fire that defied all logic. A fire in its own right, it becomes a supernatural being, very much like the Biscuit Fire in Oregon. I learned from the Biscuit Fire some really important lessons. I had a cabin 20 miles off the road down inside the wild Illinois River down on the edge of the Kamiopsis Wilderness, which starts across the river from my cabin. And I had spent 30 years pruning. I had a scarification trail. You would call it a defensible fuel profile all the way around the cabin, the 20-acre site, two cabins on it. It was the Forest Service backfire after Biscuit ignited and began to burn across the countryside from a lightning strike. It was the backfire that ended up threatening us, and backfires are lit for a variety of reasons, sometimes just to put more salvage timber on the table. It's crazy. There's no real rhyme or reason. Backfires are often lit in extremely hot, windy conditions, and so many of the backfires fly out of control, and that's what this one did. And it hit the site that we lived in, the 20-acre Forest Service inholding, and it went mostly over the top of us because it hit my fuel break, my perimeter fuel break, which was mineral ground by the time I knew the fire was coming. I was finishing scarifying. And it hit the woods around the cabin, which I had kept pruned. Now, if I were a busy little biomass collector, I would have been chipping a lot of that small material. But in this case, I just burned most of it in my fireplace. And the net effect was that the fire just kind of jumped over. Parts of it came right to the edge, but the two cabins are still there. Of course, we had put a pond in. We had water lines, which quickly burned up in the fire, but before that happened, we were able to keep the roof sprinkled. We'd taken precautions. We had done what any homeowner in the woods should do. This is a huge problem right now with fires because they're presented as a threat to life and limb and home. Whereas in reality, so many of these fires burn in the wild. The Biscuit, for example, with a perimeter encompassing 500,000 acres, burned down a couple of old miners' cabins and an old tool shed. I think it consumed in total four buildings. Nevertheless, they spent $50 million watching it burn. You don't fight big fires. You just watch them. You stay out of their way, as you do with a big fire, having engaged in a couple of firefighting episodes. You basically stay out of the way. When you don't stay out of the way, you become a fatality, like the folks in Colorado and like the folks recently down in that burn out of Prescott. So anyway, we've got this phenomena. We treat fire like it's a war zone. We have exciting media pictures of big tankers coming in and dropping retardant bombs on fires, and we talk about striking the fire, fighting the fire, frontline the fire, flanking the fire. Well, fires are normal occurring phenomena in the Western Forest. Here where we are in the west side, fire frequencies are probably closer to 120 to about 400 or 500 years in the higher elevations. And these fires, when they do burn, because of their nature, because things are so loaded up after 400 or 500 years, these fires, when they burn, oftentimes replace entire stand replacement event. So fires all over the board. There's no one generic type of fire. Most of the big exciting media-driven ones are driven by weather, which in turn has been driven lately by climate changes. Our method of dealing with fire is really archaic. We talk about the science. We say we know better. We know not to suppress, but we still suppress. You see, we're a bag of opposite views on fire. Industry makes all this noise about fire. They profit more than anybody because they get to salvage logs. And logs, even great big sugar pines that are extremely valuable, $900 to $1,000 a 1,000 board feet for big sugar pines, twice the price of a Doug fir, if they're scorched even lightly, just a light scorching, they're classified by the old log grading rules as being cullage. So the industry, in spite of all their posturing and all the noise they make about preventing fire, profits from fire. They profit hugely. It's their bulldozers that are out there in the fire line a lot of the time. In the Douglas Complex fire to the south here, which went out about a month ago, they haven't let us in to look at it yet, but anyway, in that fire, they were using feller bunchers instead of bulldozers, cruising through stands of big timber, cutting, quote, fire lines, swelling and bunching the logs in big piles so they could pick them right up after the burn went down. So this whole fire industry is a feeding frenzy from the beginning to the end. So in terms of our own work and the work that we're doing, and you know, it's a huge daunting task. Where do we start? Well, obviously, we have to start with education, but the industry puts a lot of money out here in Oregon into education, their own variety. Fire is presented as a menace to the forest rather than an attribute of a healthy ecosystem. So we're still watching industry put a lot of juice and money into poisoning fire as the enemy of the forest. So anyway, over the years, I've seen a lot of burns, and I've looked at a lot of burns after the fact. And one of the interesting observations is that thinning, including biomass removal, which a lot of thinning is intended to do, a lot of the east side thinning they're doing supposedly is to remove biomass, although they dip into the big timber. Thinning oftentimes creates a hotter burning ground fire and sometimes even contributes more to a crown fire than unthinned stands. And a couple nights ago during a conversation we were having in a public forum, I showed people slides of all these different stands that had been thinned and then consumed by fire. 20-year-old stands that were pre-commercially thinned, that's where they just cut the trees and leave them on the ground, not big enough to yard out. Commercially thinned stands that were thinned, stands that were opened up even into more open configurations than thinning, like shelter woods, sea tree cuts. When the fires got hot and heavy enough, a lot of those stands burned. And the fact that you open these stands up and you let the wind and the weather dry the interiors up and combined with the fact that you rarely get all the slash, especially the fines and the medium-sized fuels that contribute so much to the heat of the ground fire, you rarely get those out of those units. And this whole thing has become kind of really a bogus bone in the throat for a lot of us that spend time out in the woods, because we see again and again where these thinnings are consumed, and they may have even contributed to the intensity of the fire, because a lot of these manufactured stands, a lot of these managed stands, end up getting replaced with plantations. And I would be glad to send Josh some images of what happens when plantations burn. My goodness, it's just vaporized. And a lot of times those plantation fires go out when they hit the mature timber next to them. So the idea, what it amounts to, is that the idea that we can, quote, manage to prevent fire, really, just in really terse terms, is just bullshit. You can't manage to prevent fire. You can barely manage to contain or direct fire. Just that alone is a huge issue. And again, the big fires are driven by superhuman events. They're driven by events we have no control over. And no matter how much management you do, there's no guarantee that things won't be consumed. So you can see that over the long term, if you read the papers and read the science and listen to people like me that are practitioners ramble on about what we've seen and what we've learned, you begin to realize that the entire approach toward fire is wrong-sided. The whole idea that we can log or manage to prevent fire is unproven. There's no credible science that demonstrates that. To the contrary, there's a lot of science and history that demonstrate that logging is a major cause of fire. So one of the fires that jumps to my mind before the Rim Fire was the Moonlight Fire, which was in Central California, north of the Rim Fire. The Rim Fire was set by a campfire, but the Moonlight Fire burned inside a managed checkerboard. It was set off by logging. Sierra Pacific was responsible for that. It involved a lawsuit, a huge settlement, I think a settlement to the tune of about $120 or $130 million against Sierra Pacific. And it was generated, like a lot of the West Side fires, by logging in hot weather. A bulldozer's blade struck a rock, it sparked, and away it went. And again, it's got all that slash to feed on. So not only is there no proof that logging prevents fire, logging of any kind, there's ample historic evidence that logging is one of the major causative factors at different levels, either as a source of ignition or a source of fuels. So we've really got our work cut out for us. It has to start with some grassroots education. And to do that, really, we need to start looking at what age people are taught all the fear-mongering over fire, and when does that kick in, and when do people begin to see a forest fire as an evil Smokey the Bear kind of thing. So anyhow, we don't hear much about Smokey the Bear's sister, Flamaretta or whatever her name is. You know, there's another side to Smokey the Bear, because fires create a lot of insect habitat, and fires create a lot of mushroom habitat. Fires in many ways create fertile ground for berries. And so if you're a bear, a fire is not necessarily the enemy. And if you're a bear, as long as you can run and get out of the way of the fire, you know, you're not necessarily smoky. So welcome aboard. I mean, this is a really complex issue in the West, and it's a really fear and media-driven issue, and it's really difficult to find the money and the time and the funding to have any kind of public confrontation over it, to have any kind of voice, because the industry voice is just so powerful. So that's kind of what's on my brain this afternoon.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Roy. I suppose now would be a good time to open things up to any questions or comments folks might have. We don't have a ton of people on the call, so I think you can just go at it. If you have a question, just go ahead and speak up right now.
Hello, this is Lonnie Kratz. I've not done one of these conference calls, so I'm not sure how this works.
you just go ahead and ask a question.
Okay, great. Thanks. I wasn't certain that I was being heard. So
yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm unfortunately just got in from work, and I caught the end of near the end of this conversation in regard to the fact that there's no real way to prevent wildfires except caused by nature, at least. So I'm just wondering, we as a group, Save LGW, Save Linville Gorge Wilderness, are working to stop the Forest Service from using the excuse of prescribed fire will reduce risks in our wilderness, and that they would receive grant money to set fires in this wilderness. So we're looking and seeking for any kind of research that will help us defend the wilderness from, you know, this idea of prescribed burning. Is there any suggestions you might have?
Whereabouts is this wilderness?
It's in North Carolina, western North Carolina.
In the Carolinas. Well, I don't know a whole lot about that fire cycle there. So
can I fill you in a little bit?
Sure.
Sure. The upper third of the gorge, it's a major uplift section there. We have probably, we're on the major fault on the East Coast. There's an uplift of about minimum 1,500 feet along where the gorge starts to rise up, and between the bottom and the top, in fact, there's more like 2,000 feet. The upper end receives about 67 inches of rainfall a year, so the upper third is a rainforest. You know, wildfire is not common, despite the fact that they say that it is. The middle third, it's a steep gorge with lots of rhododendron and laurel, and they're telling us that, you know, they've suppressed fire in this wilderness for 50 years. It's the same thing they say everywhere they go. So it also influences the public because they really haven't done the research. They're just, you know, repeating the same, you know, support for prescribed burn everywhere. We've suppressed fire for 50 years, but, you know, there's no way they can even suppress fire in this wilderness with its steep, inaccessible canyons and so on. And then the lower third is, in fact, receives much less moisture and may be susceptible to fire. But, in fact, if they were so successful in suppression, I wonder why 4,000 of those acres have had severe fire. So we're fighting this kind of, you know, holy mistruth about the need to return fire, or that we should be thankful that they want to come in and burn the forest to reduce the risk to those that live around that that wilderness. We're just fighting, you know, something that has no fact base to it at all. And we're having a hard time leveraging the truth.
Yeah, I would take a long look into their budget. The agency tends to do things that feed their payroll.
Exactly. They've said it
kind of where they go. And if they've,
yeah,
if they've got a small timber budget, but they can hook into the fire paranoia and hook some big bucks to burn the woods, they'll burn the woods. If they can hook some big bucks to thin the woods, they'll thin the woods. If they can hook big bucks to log, they'll log. I mean, they basically follow the money. And that's
exactly,
probably economically, the best way to take them out on it is to show what a tremendous waste of money this is. It's interesting, as environmentalists, we make far too many moral and ecological arguments and not nearly enough economic arguments. And
well, I like where you go. Yeah, that's great. Well, I can tell you that the funding for this burning of the forest is the forest restoration program that's going on around the country, and
yeah,
they were granted $4.5 million. I've been lucky enough that we have somebody that's an expert, my wife, on contracts, and she's certainly going after them because it really doesn't adhere. The wilderness does not really fit this grant, and they talk
right
about removal of forest products and so on. So We have actually, last week we got message that they've got it on hold in terms of the short-term use of these grant funds for restoring, so they say, this forest. But we've also now, we're now into the forest management plan process. They just started, we've just seen the draft assessment, and we want them to write out any idea about using man-initiated fire, and we just don't know how to do that yet.
Yeah, the problem with initiating fire, at least from a Western perspective, is a good number of prescribed burns get loose. And when they get loose and burn timber, now we have a salvage logging opportunity, which, again, is funded through an endless channel.
Got
so it. Part of it, I think, is to take them on over the bogus economics. It's a wilderness area. There was never any intention in a congressional wilderness area to have active management of any kind. The whole purpose is to let it manage itself. And if it goes another 100 years without a fire, how sweet is that? And if it gets a fire next year, that's sweet too. But where you want to argue is all the better places those dollars could go. There's a lot of better ways to spend those dollars. There's rural and community. You know, they could be putting that money, that $4 million, into helping people fireproof their homes out in the woods. There's a lot of ways to spend it besides just blowing it on Forest Service frivolity, whether it's logging or whatever kind of goofy stuff they're doing. And again, it's about arguing the economy.
Well, I certainly think that will connect. I mean, we've been trying to be altruistic and say this is wilderness, but I think that the general public gets the economic piece.
Yeah. You have to beg the question, why in the hell are we lighting fires? Turn it around and play it against them. Why are we lighting fires? Aren't we supposed to be fighting fires, Steve? Swing it right around.
Well, I can tell you everything that we've done doesn't, if it says we use the word prescribed, it's in quotations, and we just call it burning. I mean,
lighting fires. They're lighting fires. This is risky business, lighting fires. I mean,
absolutely.
You might want to do some nosing around.
We have a grand
example. You might want to nose around and see how many prescribed burns have blown up into full-size blazes. I'm sure there's data on that.
Yeah, I'm starting to accumulate it. And we have an immediate example for our local, you know, for the state of North Carolina, in which the Forest Service initiated a 1,500-acre supposed control burn, and it turned into 21,000 acres. So, I mean, if
perfect.
That doesn't resonate with the public.
Perfect. And then you can talk about not only the money that was wasted on lighting the fires and prescribing the burns, but all the money that was wasted fighting the 21,000-acre burn.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we need to start looking at economics a little bit more to gain more public backing. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, the public understands that. When you start talking about the ecological nuances, you go over people's heads a lot, but when you talk about the dollars wasted on doing really stupid stuff like lighting fires, you know, why are we spending $4 million to light fires? Especially when one of them became a 21,000-acre blaze. Is anybody home? Hello?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. We've talked about it, but we've hesitated because we're not sure if that attracts the right attention but it probably is. In retrospect now, it seems to make a lot more sense. And then I really appreciate your time, and I don't want to dominate anybody else that might have a question, but we have this same, and it's really in this mountainous region, there is a great deal of rain that takes place. Fire with frequency, that widespread fire is very infrequent, and yet they are now wanting to use the prescribed burns across this region. And I think some of it is economics, like you say, and we have other suspicions that it's a precursor for possibly for, hydraulic fracking, and maybe it's also a precursor for, I don't know. We don't understand because none of it really logically applies to this region.
Hello there.
Well, good luck.
Folks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hello, folks. This is Denny Haldeman from Chattanooga. I just joined you late. and have been listening, and I appreciate the gentlemen that have been having this discussion. There is a man named Lance Olson who is on the Stumps Don't Lie list, who does a considerable amount of bullshit patrol on this issue that shows
cool.
that, you know, prescribed fires and logging for biomass is counterintuitive. And I would hope that we tap into Lance's vast supply of information that he's accrued over the years.
Superb.
And
I love
I
it.
I agree that wildfires in the East only, you know, Smokey was into fire suppression. Now he's into only you can prevent forests by burning them up and into incinerators. yeah, only you can prevent forests. And so anyway, we have some resources out there.
Okay.
One thing is
Thank
to
you.
Say, ignore the science on what really happens in fire-suppressed areas, what really happens in logged-over areas where they build roads, create new inroads for human-induced fires into the previous wilderness areas. And we really need to kind of focus more toward the lies of the science that they're using and expose those.
Thank you. Well, I find it very interesting that... Hey, can whoever's making that noise there deal with that? Thank you. I find it very interesting that the fire topic now is going nationwide. Typically, this is a Western issue, so I find it very, very intriguing. And I have actually even seen arguments for logging around wildfire in the Northeast, up where I am. So I think... Sorry about that. Not sure what that sound was. Can whoever's phone is doing that maybe take care of that? Anyway, so this fire issue is clearly a national one. I have a question, Roy. Would you be able to speak briefly about the precautions people can take around their home to prevent wildfires from burning their stuff as opposed to going into the backcountry and logging, which seems to be industry and government's solution?
Yeah, I would think that people would want to do some looking in, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is the materials used in the home. Shake roofs are a no-no. Fire-resistant composition, not wise. You need to pay attention to the roof because the roof is the major source of fire spreading across the terrain from house to house. It's all about burning embers, hitting the roof, and lighting up the roofing before anybody can put the fire out.
But it's more important to address the building. I am guilty. I built in the fire interface in the woods.
Right.
Okay. And suddenly we're expending heroic efforts for people like me who want to live in the woods to save homes. And, you know, we're building into the woods.
Yeah. And you can start with. You can start with the material that you build the house out of. That's the starting point.
Yeah.
There's even an outfit here in this part of Oregon. I don't have their contact information handy, but they have foam suppression systems that can be plugged into homes. They cost anywhere from $7,000 to $12,000, and basically what it does, it just covers your house in foam in a fire event. People don't want to spend that kind of money, but when the fire comes, they wish they had. And the same with a steel roof. A steel roof is an expensive piece of work, but the steel roof can keep you from burning down. I've seen photographs, even in the Berkeley fire. It was interesting, even in that urban fire we had years ago when I toured that. It was easy to see why some homes burned and some didn't. So all the wood houses with all the fun woodwork and all the wood graffiti and the fun shake roofs, they just went poof.
Yep.
A lot of the houses that survived the Berkeley fire were houses built in the 30s, and guess what they had for roofs? Tile. And they were stucco-finished homes. Those homes tended to stand up. So you start with the material that you're building the house with. You either modify it or think it over before you build. And then the next step you take is the zone around the house. We call that the defensible fuel profile. The zone around the house, You get all the vegetation back from the house. You don't have your house overgrown. You don't leave big trees hanging over the top. You basically, you know, this is kind of a rough way to say it. Excuse my political incorrectness, but you basically need to clear cut around your house if you live in a fire zone. You need to keep it small. You need to keep the shrubs down there at the level of reprod. You need to keep everything under control. That's what saved my cabins, was having that vegetation cleared out all the way around the cabins. There were trees that I had to backfall. There were a couple of large trees up the slope from one cabin site, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and backfall. In other words, I had to fall them up the slope so I wouldn't wipe out the cabin, which was work. But I got those trees down, and I was so glad when that fire hit, because they would have burned. Chunks of them would have come flaming down on top of the cabin. I would have lost my structure. So a lot of it is commonsensical. There's lots of literature on what and how to do to protect your house. And it starts, I think, with, I'm assuming that somebody's going to build in the woods. I mean, the logical thing is don't build in the woods. But if you're going to build in the woods, start with the right materials and then go to creating that defensible zone around your house. And then think about your water system. It might be a good idea to have 3,000, 4,000 gallons worth of cistern uphill from the house like we had. It might be a good idea to have a pond so a pumper could come in and draw water out of the pond. I mean, these are all things to think about if you're living in a fire zone. Like the people in Colorado, for God's sakes, they're building houses in pine and mixed conifer forest types that routinely burn every 20, 30 years. So, you know, you're building a house that is likely to burn inside your 30-year mortgage period. So that, I think, in a nutshell, that's pretty much my feelings, and they are based on my own experience.
So there are some government programs out there to make people's homes fire safe. I know some folks who have taken advantage of that. I believe a lot of it is federal funding, some of it's state funding, or siphoned through the state. However, my understanding is a lot of that funding is being cut back. Meanwhile, sure, they are increasing the funding for logging to supposedly prevent wildfire.
Yep.
So my question,
right,
really would be, do you think it's a worthwhile endeavor to do a lobbying press to the politicians to remind them that if they're going to put money towards wildfire, it should be towards dealing with the areas around people's homes? Do you think that they would be receptive to that?
I think that's a great direction. I think it's a great direction because it gets public support. Why? You know, in other words, instead of wasting money, quote, logging, or wasting money, quote, restoring, or wasting money with prescribed burns, why don't we provide federal dollars to these subdivisions and neighborhoods that are up in the woods to encourage and help and fund them to create defensible zones in their neighborhoods? Why don't we go to work on this? And if we've got little tiny roads that don't have turnouts, that aren't big enough for vehicles, for firefighting vehicles, or little sharp turns, hey, that's a place to put some money. We can put a bulldozer to work cutting out some turns. We can put some equipment to work in the road. I mean, why don't we do that instead of just hauling more trees out of the woods? I think it's a
some
very logical argument.
Some people will say that's like encouraging hurricane victims to keep building on the coast.
Well, they'll say that, but the reality is we've got millions of people that are already living in the woods, you see. That's the problem. Now, if you were to have that program, if you were to help the millions of people that are already living in fire-prone woods, and then at the same time you were to promote a program to rezone or rethink giving further permits to live in the woods, then you might be able to counteract that hurricane concept. You know, it might be more than just a single prong if you go public. It might be multi-pronged. You might question the idea that we're going to let more people move into the woods, and at the same time you might look at ways to provide some insulation for the people that are there.
Yeah, we're not going to stop that, but getting back to the concept of, like, we need to burn it down preemptively to protect people via...
I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
Via, only you can prevent forests, via, like, we need to burn it up in incinerators to make energy. How do
sure,
we deal with that?
Log it to save it.
Huh?
Yeah, you point out how ridiculous it is.
Yes, but how do we deal with that concept? That's the sales pitch that's being used.
You have to have the horsepower to get up and run against it. And most of those old archaic concepts are so easy to defeat, a lot of them just don't take more than a soundbite or two. Really.
But a lot of the issue is, a lot of the problem is that we have the media who, I think it's a combination of ignorance, as in they're not really doing the research, and because emotion sells newspapers. So moonscape, devastation, all of those things, you know, fan those flames, people are going to want to buy the newspapers. That's my, as a somewhat journalist, that I think is part of what's going on in that regard. And we have a hard time convincing people of doing the rational, logical thing as opposed to just getting freaked out and then just dumping a bunch of money into it. Sounds good. Sure, go ahead and cut down all the trees. So
hey,
we have
hey
our
guys,
work cut out for us.
Can I ask you a question, Roy and whoever else might be on? Are you familiar with the Fire Learning Network and the fact that in the year 2000, the Nature Conservancy was given $1 million to start the Fire Learning Network to create the propaganda to get public acceptance on prescribed fire?
The Nature Conservancy is also involved with advocating for logging in advance of fires for the fire fuel reduction. So, yeah, that's not a surprise.
Wow.
Well, the Nature Conservancy logs a lot of their own properties. I have consulting friends that work for the Nature Conservancy. Yeah, they're not exactly beyond the grease in the whole mess. You know, they're deeply embedded in the grease.
It's another tactic.
But I think what I'm trying to say is there is a very, if you know of the Fire Learning Network, it's very nebulous, but there's a lot of money there, and they're all working on the propaganda machine that fire is good. I meet people in the wilderness, young people that should know better, that think they are ecologically aware. And the first thing, when I mention, you know, they're planning to burn this wilderness, the first thing they say is fire is good. Well, it is good if it's natural, but it's not good if it's, you know, induced by man.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, when they say fire is good, they mean it in the terms of prescribed burning, and that's what I'm talking about.
And there's definitely differences in the ecosystem and the fire regimes in the West Coast and the East Coast, for sure.
Well, the East Coast.
What about differences? Sorry.
The East Coast.
What about differences? Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, the East Coast has also its differences on lee side and wet side forests. You know, much like the Pacific Northwest has. You know,
what I'm hearing is that I've got some research, and if anybody's interested, check out savelgw.org. New research from the West is saying that when it comes to a severe fire, prescribed burning doesn't work. If it's a drought, it's going to burn. So in addition to that, they're saying that if it's about species diversity, you know, snags and severe burned areas are part of the network of nature, and that it is that's how nature has evolved. That in the areas where there were severe fire historically, it needs to be that so that species diversity can continue. Those snags are the perches for birds of prey. Those snags are the feeding ground for, woodpeckers and, you know, flowers, and it creates a patchwork of something different, you know, that is in fact diversity.
And Jerry Franklin, from was he from Washington? The forester who said that the tree begins the second half of its life once it falls down in the forest and creates a hot spot of biodiversity.
I love it. It's great.
Hey, Samantha, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, it's really hard to do this. I have to pick up the phone. Okay, so my question for Roy is, can you comment on differences between people use the terms logging or cutting? What's the difference between that? Is there any time when it's, like, helpful to cut trees in order to reduce fires from for maybe hitting like old growth or something like that?
Well, ecologically, in the dry pine forest types, there's another factor to consider besides fire resistance, and that is the understory. The dense understories drink up all the moisture, and what we're seeing in parts of Arizona, and this is from an ecological perspective, and I've been there and seen it many times, in these very dry pine sites, we're seeing the old pines fading away because the understories are more aggressive and can outcompete the older pines for moisture. I hit 70 this year, and I understand how easily my 30-year-old son can outcompete me for things. This is not a mystery to me. You get older, you just don't have the vigor that you had when you were younger, and that's the problem in parts of the dry pine forest. The old trees simply don't have the vigor to compete with all the youthful trees that are occupying the site. So there's a reason beyond just biomass or a reason beyond just thinning to log to go in and relieve those sites. But the best way to do it and the way that puts the most local people to work and the way that creates the less carnage with the agency is to go in and just cut, lop, scatter, or cut, lop, pile, burn, your choice. I can show people thousands of acres where I've set up and supervised those kinds of operations in dry forest types, dry pine types.
But there's
you
also
get
the
two,
concept where you go in, you cut, log, scatter, you create more sunlight, you dry out the soil faster, less water retention.
Well, let me just say in these dry forest types, you're not dealing with a whole lot of rainfall or water to start with. You know, we're talking 15 inches a year, maximum amount. In a good year. Yeah, but it doesn't, let me just assure you that in a dry pine forest, it doesn't work that way. It just simply doesn't work that way. What you do is you end up losing the large old trees. I know this is an unpleasant concept, but there is a reason to treat those stands beyond just biomass or looking to log. But the stands I'm talking about that we treated, I've actually been able to go in and look at stands that were treated 20 and 30 years ago and seeing the old pines picking up a better growth increment. And when those old pines stop growing, you know, when a tree stops growing, it dies. And we think, well, there's nothing wrong with a dead tree. But the problem is we've got vast areas where the old pines are dying. And it's not natural. It wouldn't have happened had they not suppressed fire. There would have been many fires in those stands over the last 100 years.
It would not have happened had we come in with chainsaws and feller bunchers to manage forests.
Well, coming in with a feller buncher is really different from coming in with chainsaws and tennis shoes and a Bic lighter. You see?
Right, but that's the issue, is that industry is not going to be coming in there doing those sorts of manual projects because there's no money in it. So that's typically not what happens.
Yeah.
In an ideal world. They would go in there if they would do any form of thinning. They would be going in there and they would need to cut larger diameter stuff to pay for their project.
Of course. I'm talking about not logging. Logging is when you yard the bole of the tree out of the woods for whatever reason. That's called logging. Logging is not the same as cutting. See, so we're not talking logging here. I'm not talking feller bunchers or forager harvesters or delimmers or any of that. I'm talking chainsaws, brush cutters, and Bic lighters.
But there's currently no entities that are actually doing that form of treatment.
Well, that's because you can't get it budgeted. The problem out here in the West is getting the budget to do anything other than log.
Because everything has been under the guise of restoration, under the guise of fire prevention, when it's just commercial logging.
Sure. I mean, I can send Josh a really simple little article I did about 2 years ago. It's been all over the board. People have used it in a lot of places, and it's just a simple question. Will more logging restore forest? And the answer is no. 97% of the time. There might be an exception, a 3%, a 4%, a 5% exception. But most of the time, no. We haven't even touched on the real problem with logging, which is the compaction of the soil. You know, it's easy for everybody to forget about the soil.
And compaction, not only compaction, but damage to residual trees, damage to the biodiversity that constitutes most of a forest, which is not a tree.
The compaction, and then the erosion, the destruction of the humus of the A layer in the soil, the runoff, the unchecked overland water flows. I mean, all of this.
How about the carbon oxidation from the soil?
Yeah, all of this. When you get up into those higher elevation cascade forests, you get up into mountain hemlock and stands that are up above 3,500, 4,000 feet, most of your carbon is stored in the first 10 to 12 inches of soil.
Yeah. I flew over Missoula, Montana forest several years ago, two decades ago, actually, and the reestablishment of plantations with because of the frost factor being out in the open, they couldn't reestablish plantations on the high elevation forest.
Nope. Takes a long time. It goes to brush, and then maybe over 500, 1,000 years, it evolves trees again, but only after it's built some insulation.
And we lost 500 to 1,000 years of carbon sequestration.
Yep.
Well, unfortunately, the biomass industry is using all of these topics, and they're spinning things in a way that's it's pretty successful politically and in the public eye. They're taking all the issues. So what they're saying is, oh, every time a wildfire burns, et cetera, there's air pollution, right? What they neglect is what they're saying is, okay, let's cut the forest down, burn them in biomass incinerators that has 24/7 pollution right near low-income communities. They bring in climate change. They say every time a forest burns, there's CO2 release. Again, there's the disconnect between the fact that, okay, then this forest will definitely burn in your incinerators, constantly emitting more CO2 than many coal facilities. They're tying into the whole emotional aspect of the fear of fire.
Sure.
We've got our work cut out for us. It's the vast majority of what's getting out there in the media. And in my opinion, obviously aside from the legislative push, we need to be inserting our opinion a little more into the newspapers. I'm going to be sending out an email to the listservs asking people this month of October, where we're discussing the wildfire issue, to submit letters to the editor to various newspapers, and particularly the San Francisco Chronicle, which right now is actually not running my response to a biomass energy propaganda piece. And their newspaper has actually been putting out a lot of propaganda, not just running biomass industry op-ed pieces, but their articles themselves are basically biomass industry propaganda. So I'll be sending out some info on that. I'm hoping some folks can assist me in at least responding with some letters to the editor on that existing piece or some other op-eds. But we definitely need to also contact the journalists to remind them that, at the very least, point out the other side of their nonsense.
Hey, Josh, are you there?
Yes.
Josh, you there? I'm going to jump out. I've got to go down to the office and finish up some business.
Well, perfect timing because it's the end of the call. And thank you, Roy, Public Interest Forester, Director of our forest. Thanks for being on our call. Thanks for leading this discussion. And thanks to everyone who made it on the call. And, Roy, you can go ahead and jump off. I'm just going to finish this up here.
Thanks, all of you. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Roy.
Take care.
You too. Okay.
And then just really quick, since we're recording this and I want to have the entirety of it. So we have these national anti-biomass incineration calls, the first Thursdays of every month. Our next call is going to be on November 7th. We'll be discussing some of the nuisances associated with biomass incineration, particularly the noise one, which is happening right now in these new facilities. There's a lot of noise. It's keeping people up. And to get a notice of the future calls and links to this recording and the notes, you can contact me, Josh Schlossberg, at josh@energyjustice.net, and you'll already receive this if you're subscribed to the Biomass Opponents listserv. So thanks again, everyone, for being on the call. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.